and welcome to the Matthew Clark Podcast, Episode 2, where we sit down with the industry's key figures. Hugh Crichton, winemaker at Fidel Wines, is in London for a few days, and we will be talking with him today about his New Zealand wines and his limited availability legacy range, featuring a stunning Chardonnay, Syrah, and Cabernet Sauvignon.
So Hugh, could you give us a little bit of background on Vidal and the history and how you started producing wine?
Yeah, sure. So Vidal Estate was established in 1905 by Anthony Vidal, who was a Spanish immigrant and a winemaker. He came out in 1888 to help his uncle, who is also a winemaker in New Zealand. So there's a lot of heritage with our company. One of the four oldest within Hawke's Bay, and Hawke's Bay is one of the four oldest wine regions in New Zealand. So that's when we first started, first vintage in 1905, and then we were overtaken, or not overtaken, I should have said merged with Villa Maria, and they purchased us in 1976. So we run independently as our own winery within Hawke's Bay.
Excellent. So the people we've been talking to, a lot of the wineries, the winemakers have a philosophy that they like to follow with their wines when they're producing them. Would you say you've got one? And if so?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think our philosophy is driven largely by the style of wine our vineyards produce and our climate. But even so, within that framework, that sort of climatic framework you have as a winemaker, got it quite a strong leeway. For example, when you pick the grapes, so for example, Chardonnay, if we picked it at 22.5 bricks, bring it into the winery, make it the way we normally make Chardonnay, and it will come out with as a wine with freshness of acidity, with a flavour profile that might be more citrus grapefruit, and will come out with relatively low alcohols. Now, let's say that vineyard, the quality of the fruit stays the same, but we decide to pick it 2 weeks later, then we'll make a completely different wine, even though we make it the same way. So the acidity will be lower, the sugar will be lower, therefore the alcohol will be lower, this flavour profile, sorry, the sugar will be higher, so the alcohol will be higher. The flavour profile will be more in stone fruit characters as opposed to citrus. We could make it exactly the same way, but you'll make completely different wines. So having an idea of the sort of style of wine you're trying to make is critical. So for us, our style is about freshness, so good acidity levels. It's not about getting the fruit overripe, so moderate alcohols because the sugar's not too high, and complexity as well. So we just don't want it to be about fruit, you know, we want other things going on. So you'll get that from French oak, you'll get that from natural ferment, and you'll get that from time on lees, for example. So stylistically, we're trying to make elegant but concentrated wines with real personality and texture. And I think a lot of that's driven from the time I had personally over in Europe over quite a long period of time, sort of influenced where we're going. But fundamentally, the vineyard is the one that drives it. But as a winemaker, you've got a choice of direction.
Good. And you mentioned before that you're very lucky to be working with George Vistanich, and he allows you to focus much more on the quality rather than the quantity. So that must have a bearing there too. Do you want to tell us a bit more about the regions that you work with? Because obviously Marlborough is big for Sauvignon Blanc, and moving into that with Pinot, but you're obviously based in Hawke's Bay. It's a very special area for you.
Yeah, so Hawke's Bay for us is all about Chardonnay, Syrah and the Merlot Cabernet blends. And I would say in the world of wine, Hawke's Bay makes some of the greatest examples without any exaggeration whatsoever. So that's where our local passion lies. Outside of that, as you mentioned, Marlborough, of course, has got an incredible following around the world for Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Noir in particular, but also for Riesling and some other varieties. So Sauvignon Blanc for us down there is about tropical fruit, not too much acidity. You're always going to have some acidity with Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc. That's just part of the game down there, but not too much. They're not too austere, not too mineral. And I think the wines down there, with the Pinot included, have a real purity and fragrance about them. So there's a real freshness which comes from the climate. for us, it's just it's a matter of moderating that acidity so it's not too high for the consumer when they're drinking it.
Good. So obviously you started off the first 70 or so years as a fairly small business, and you became part of a much bigger thing when you bought out by Villa. Can you tell us a bit more about the people involved in the winemaking process there?
Yeah, so being bought out by Villa was a really positive move for us for several reasons. One was Sir George really wanted Vital to operate independently and not be, I guess, mopped up into the bigger parent company from a kind of vineyard or winery point of view. So we are small. There's only four of us in the winery. During vintage, we take on another four or five. So it is, we've got small vineyard plots. There's a lot of handwork. We're not really big and industrial like a lot of other companies. So we've got almost a boutique feel about it. But having the benefit of being owned by a larger company, I guess, who at the helm of that company, Sir George, has complete focus on quality regardless of, you know, which of the brands it is. But by having that sort of support from George, it means that we can completely focus on growing grapes and making wine. So, for example, when it comes to auditing or finance or health and safety, of course, we're very supportive of all the health and safety regulations, but they do demand quite a bit of time from you. And so if you can sort of, in effect, outsource that, to head office and have it looked after people who actually love doing it and are actually quite good at it instead of us who don't like it and we're not very good at it, allows us to, you know, focus on what we love, which is growing grapes and making wine. And I think, you know, for a lot of companies, sadly, you could be spending, you know, a quarter of your time doing all that non-wine related stuff. So it's a big positive. And of course, for Sir George, it's all about the quality of the wine. And when we were talking earlier, he just has no question that about, you know, the quality of what goes into the bottle should be outstanding. And if it's not going to be good enough, it doesn't go in the bottle.
Sure. Now, it sounds like you've got a great relationship. So on the quality, Mark, because we kind of lead into the next question, which just wanted to talk to you about how, particularly in 2016, with it being a large quantity vintage, you talked about dropping fruit to maintain the actual quality of the grapes. Do you want to just talk around that a little bit, and then maybe make a comparison between the 16 and 17 and give us a little heads up on what's happening there?
Yeah, so I mean there's a lot of generalizations about yield and how big a vintage is and how small it is. I think the important thing to get to the bottom of, to delve into, is what program does the company have, or what's your view on yield control. So when you have a big vintage, what people are meaning there was that they're saying that the vines produce naturally quite a lot of fruit. But as a grower, you've got the opportunity to go through and drop fruit on the ground. So the greedy people, and probably the less quality focused companies, will choose not to drop fruit on the ground. Now, when you do that and you have large yields coming through, you tend to produce less quality because there's less concentration. You tend to play a bit of Russian roulette with the climate at the end of the growing season, because if it cools down quickly and you've got a lot of fruit to ripen, the vine just doesn't ripen them. So whilst 2016 was a much bigger vintage than 2017, all it meant for us was that in 2016 we went through and dropped a lot more fruit on the ground. So as I often say, you never want to do that when the financial controller is going to walk through the vineyard, because they see all this cash on the ground. But George is pretty clear on yield control, and we love it too because we make better wine. So 17 being lower yields naturally just means we could drop less fruit on the ground. But I think it's all about setting the vine up to be able to ripen the amount of fruit, and the season will sometimes give you more than what you need, so you just have to turn a blind eye and drop it on the ground.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. So with New Zealand Sauvignon being the real buzzword at the moment, so probably up there with things like Pinot Grigio and Prosecco in popularity.
Yeah.
Do you think this is something that's going to carry on as it is, or do you think some people saying that maybe they're finding New Zealand Sauvignon a little bit too overpowering, it's going to damage your business?
Look, I really think it will continue, and I know there's a lot of people out there in the industry who are questioning that. The style, you know, I mean, wine style always evolves over time, so the style could change. So, you know, if the wines might become a bit more elegant, if you like, a bit more restrained, not so powerful, not so, you know, in your face, for want of a better term. But I guess you just have to be careful in how far you take that, because one of the reasons for success is that people love the concentration, they love the intensity of the fruit, they love the difference that wine presents compared to any other country in the world that produces Sauvignon Blanc. So you've got to be careful. You've got to listen to the consumer, and if they're still buying it and they're liking it, then you don't want to change too much. You might make, you know, small changes, but I don't know. I think, you know, sure, there will be people who move on from Sauvignon Blanc and discover new varieties, but it's such a goddamn good drink, I think. You know, it's so flavoursome, it's so aromatic. If you can get the balance right so it's not too acidic, you will always attract new consumers because it is a good drink. It's full of flavour. And they might move on to try other stuff, but you'll always have new consumers coming through. So I'm not the pessimist that many are. I think it's here for good.
Good. I guess within Matthew Clark, we're seeing a trend at the moment towards like Italian red, so that appassimento style, so you get a lot of flavour for your money. And the New Zealand Sauvignon can fit into that, where, you know, you're not paying a huge amount of money, but you are getting a big flavour. So
yeah,
it kind of fits the market right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So given that that's your kind of, that's your bread and butter, you'd be silly not to make Sauvignon Blanc and maybe Pinot as your first red.
Yeah.
What do you see as the future for Chardonnay and Syrah? Because I know it's a real passion of yours to have these grapes and do great things with them.
Oh, look, I'm hugely excited about both those varieties, and also the Merlot Cabernets that come out of Hawke's Bay. When you look at those wines from a pure quality point of view, they're world class, and I don't think there's any question about that, and that's coming through in blind tastings with some pretty smart wines from around the world. So you're right, Sauvignon Blanc is the bread and butter and has opened a lot of doors around the world for us. Chardonnay, Syrah and the Merlot Cabernet blends, but particularly the Chardonnay and Syrah, we see us sort of turning a lot of heads, and that bodes well for the future of those varieties. And I think critically as well, those varieties can build New Zealand into the even more premium market. So seven, you know, the average price of a bottle of New Zealand wine is higher than any other country in the world, in the UK. But when you bring into the mix a bit more of the volume of Chardonnay and Syrah and Bordeaux blends at the higher price points, I think we're only going to take brand New Zealand more into the, you know, quality arena.
Okay. So again, I think the message there is really about the quality and not comparing maybe a New Zealand Chardonnay to an Aussie one, but comparing it to a Burgundy and likewise the Syrah to Rhone blends rather than to just a Shiraz from down the road.
Exactly. So I think, I mean, a good case in point was a tasting we did in China in Shanghai for 40 wine professionals in May, and there was 6 Hawke's Bay, very good Hawke's Bay wines there, and our Legacy was there as one of them. And we put in that blind tasting Oprion, first growth from Bordeaux, that sells for, you know, oodles. We had Lynch Barge, which was the second growth, and then we had Clinet, and they would taste it at blind wine professionals, and they selected their top wine, and they selected the 13 Legacy Cab Sav Merlot. So I think, yeah, comparing it to regions of a similar style is the right way to go. So yeah, Chardonnay, as you said, for Burgundy, and Syrah for Northern Rhone. So not too overripe, not too alcoholic, and still good acidity.
Good. Okay, so one last question just to close off, and I promise we won't tell Sir George what you say to this one. I guess you're quite happy where you are at the moment doing what you're doing, but if you had the opportunity to go and work in any region in the world with any variety, what would you choose?
Oh, this sounds a little bit corny, but to be honest, I'd probably stay in Hawke's Bay. And I would probably go, if I could only pick one variety, and it's tough because, you know, every variety has its own beauty. And if I had to pick one red and one white, and that, I know that wasn't the question, but if it was one red and one white, I'd go Syrah and Chardonnay. But if I could only pick one, I'd go 100% Chardonnay. And I think we're only just starting to see these high quality wines get in the front of some of the great sommeliers of the world and wine merchants. And every time I show the Legacy Chardonnay and even the Reserve, there's almost a shock of wow, this is incredible. I didn't believe that New Zealand Chardonnay was like this. So yeah, if I couldn't stay in Hawke's Bay, I'd probably end up in Burgundy.
It's interesting. I asked the same question to Catherine Mello last week, and obviously she does a lot of work with Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Noir in the Loire Valley, and she said she wanted to come and work with you guys. So,
oh wow! All right.
Perhaps a little exchange program could go on.
You know, we're always into that. Into keeping the eyes open.
Well, listen, Hugh, it's been a pleasure. That's a wrap for us. So thank you for talking to us, and we'll see you again soon.
Awesome. It's always a pleasure to be here. And if any of you guys end up in New Zealand, please come and see us in Hawke's Bay. And you'll be able to get my contact information. I can give you a quick look around the winery.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To find out more about the Fidel range, visit the Matthew Clark website. And don't forget to join us next time when we will be talking to Nuno from Quinta dos Mercas.